Greetings, Sleepy Salsa here on this Saturday, May 5th of 2012, and welcome to the 52nd episode of the Last Bestiale podcast. This broadcast is kindly hosted over at youhavetreadonme.com. I should also take this opportunity to mention that the opening theme is Ashley Alicizes a Puzzling Predicament, and the break will feature Burn 7's Tomahawk, with the outro being Bose's King's Quest, all of them available pursuant to Creative Commons attribution, specifically CC BY NC SA 3.0 unported. For any other content that may not be of original authorship by yours truly, any such material is used under the sincere intention of fair use. For more information on Creative Commons, visit them at creativecommons.org. If you wish to understand the nature of the situation we are all suffering under and what can be done about it, feel free to visit the Last Bestiale blog, which is located over at The Last Bestiale. Bestiale is spelled B-A-S-T-I-L-L-E. TheLastBestiale.wordpress.com. The blog is also now available in Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure Socket Layer, known by its acronym as HTTPS. We will be taking calls all throughout this broadcast, as well as any questions through the YHTOM listener chat room, which is located primarily at yhtom.chatango.com, as well as on youhavetreadonme.com/radio_show.html. Also, it is imperative that any questions be constructive and on topic as much as possible. Believe me, although it is hard to not get off on tangents, staying on tonight's subject will be much appreciated, especially for the sake of the listening audience. If you have questions, please limit it to something we have covered or are currently discussing. As an additional courtesy, please mute your mic when we bring you in until we announce you by name. This episode, we are going to focus on communism. Since the beginning of time, the collective has always been at odds with the individual. As the smallest minority on Earth, the individualist has been constantly challenged by both the difficulties of overcoming his circumstances, as well as being constrained by gaggles of mindless zombies composed of various flavors. These zombies will follow any despotic train of thought, provided that they are sufficiently convinced enough that the junk ideology invented by their vampiric overlords seems beneficial to them, even if it is in fact detrimental to their individual welfare. The beauty and wealth of the world is being systematically destroyed by bad ideas. Our guest tonight is Philo, who is a monetary reform theorist. Tonight we will be discussing communism as it is practiced here in America, as well as some recommendations on how to counter it. With that said, let us turn to our guest. Philo, are you with us?
Yeah.
How are you doing tonight on this fine evening, sir?
All right. How about yourself?
Not too badly. A little strung out on a few projects, but otherwise things are going well. Okay, let's get started, Philo. So, especially for those of our listening audience who haven't really had a chance to study it, Philo, what is communism?
Well, I would say that this world that we're living in right now is communism. You know, your intro there, we could really break that apart and analyze just what you said probably for 2 hours. Because, I mean, just listening to it tonight is like I have a whole different perspective than the last time I heard that intro or read it on the blog or something, you know. Because, I mean, ultimately what it boils down to is unless you're living like the Native Americans did or some indigenous culture somewhere on the planet right now, you're actually part of a commune and practicing communism as we speak. It's all actually communism. The whole idea of and you were saying, talking about the beauty of the earth. You know, what popped up in my mind was, how is that defined? Is that defined by the natural resources, the natural environment, or is it defined by what man has created with technology? And because you really can't develop technology without a communist system, you know, without completely controlling the market, you know, in an actual free market, you know, is anything gonna get done as far as technological advances? That's you know, really debatable, unless some kind of external force is guiding the course of mankind, telling him what to do every day, you know, where to go to work, and don't worry about what your provisions are going to be. You're going to be provided for, or something, you know. But we developed this accounting tool called money, generally, and pretty much that means that some power elite is ultimately going to be guiding the course of mankind, and everybody's going to be at their mercy, so to speak. Even they're at their mercy, because you know, it's what's happening is it is kind of a self-destruction path of the earth, you know, or at least exterminating the people, you know, if not all life potentially, with all the GMOs and radiation and pharmaceuticals we're poisoning ourselves with. You know, it's all part of this controlled market. You can't call it free market by any means. You know, there's a private industry, private power elite in control of the money supply, and maybe you could argue, well, that's the only thing not free market about this system. Everything else is free market. But no, that doesn't really logically follow, that you can have a private power elite controlling the money supply, and then everything else is free market, you know.
Well, Philo, I thought that communism was basically this, you know, partly vanguard method where you have like the party and the industries are owned by the state. That's true, but it's this kind of, it's basically Soviet Russia. I thought that was the only version of communism that was communism.
Well, that's how the power elite propagandist Karl Marx defines communism. But I say he was a propagandist, and everything he wrote was meant to mess with your mind. Everything he wrote actually served the power elite. It's not too hard to figure out on close analysis. But you could call what he was talking about Communism 2, or the second level of communism. The first level is what it actually is, you know, a power elite creating a cash supply, and then creating this market where technology develops, and supposedly the standard of living for everybody goes up, but there's always this huge slave pool, huge pool of people living in poverty at the bottom under this so-called capitalist system. So what Karl Marx wrote about, and the followers of Karl Marx, the self-proclaimed communists, they're just like second level or communists too. And then the real true communism is the whole world with all these, the spectrum of political systems in conflict with each other, while the industrialists and bankers just totally pillage the natural resources of the planet and create this labor force of drones, even though they believe they're in a free market, to extract the natural resources. And then so what we have is a system where, if you can just envision that there was no money and all you could see is natural resources and labor producing products with the natural resources, and then giving a large percentage of everything they produce is being given to these people above them, you know, and if you visualize a pyramid, you know, with the bankers at the very top not producing anything, but just simply profiting off of the cash supply, loaning up pieces of paper at usury, which is, you know, that's all they're not risking anything, but possibly losing their pieces of paper, which is a small percentage of the cash supply. They're not producing anything. And then the guys directly below them are the industrialists that, you know, sure, they make some decisions for their daily wage, you know, but they're the wealthiest people on the planet. And everything they have, all their mansions, their yachts, and everything is all being constructed by poor people and basically given to them, because the poor people are brainwashed into believing that they're getting paid to build this stuff and give it to these rich people. You know? And that's how investors, we call them, that's how they rationalize what they're doing too, is they're the ones providing economic opportunities for the poor people. That's why they deserve to be so rich.
Yeah. So, Philo, I think what you're telling us, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that communism is essentially plutocracy, and for the listeners, plutocracy is ruled by the rich. Would that be accurate to say?
Yeah. And it all stems from the controlled opposition that we're constantly in, the constant conflict, mainly over wealth redistribution. You'll notice a lot of the things I say, the way I speak, my rhetoric sounds a lot like Karl Marx. But I'm not talking about a progressive tax by any means. I'm not talking about redistributing anybody's wealth by any means by progressive taxation. And for instance, Karl Marx was an advocate of the gold standard, which is part of how the banking elites stay in control by amassing huge vaults of gold, and so people will always go to them for their currency, because we go through these cycles of we're tired of the evil fiat currency. It doesn't work, so we need a gold standard. And then the bankers say, well, I happen to have a huge vault of gold to back the currency. And so, you know, they're still in control of the currency. And then after the economy crashes under that system, then people are, you know, we need to go back to the fiat currency. Hold on. I mean, go ahead and talk for a second.
Right. Well, I think that's important to kind of look at, is is look at where the gold is. I think that's definitely something that's kind of important. I think it's also been mentioned on previous episodes too, guys, the issue of whether there is any gold at Fort Knox, as well as where's any of the stored gold and who controls it. I mean, there's also the possibility too that Fort Knox doesn't have any gold as well, but of course, you know, that would need to be ascertained.
It doesn't matter if it what if it did? And they said, we're going to go to a gold standard. Who gets the gold-backed currency? How does it get into circulation? They're not going to just issue it to people. They're going to loan it out at usury to people. So
yeah, charging them interest, yeah.
Yeah. It really boils down to, if you use a currency as an accounting tool, you're going to have a power elite in control of your life. It's kind of a dismal way of looking at things, a dismal conclusion, but it's important to live in reality. And if that's the truth, then, you know, you might as well face it sooner the better and approach life from that point of view. But if anybody thinks that, oh, there's got to be some solution, I'm here to, you know, I'll always be here to work with anybody that wants to see if they can develop something better than what I came up with, and then ultimately realize that, this ain't gonna work, you know. Because I've developed basically a core, you know, on my YouTube channel, you know, just really low budget, not planned out or anything videos. I developed a school of thought, the physics of money, basically. And there isn't another monetary reformist out there that has got anything like it, you know, because, I mean, if they go down the path that I did, eventually they're going to come to the same conclusion. Oh, yeah, there's no solution to a currency that is not controlled by private bankers, and, you know. Go ahead.
Oh, right, of course. Now, would it be accurate to say that socialism is a lighter shade of communism?
It's just another term on the spectrum of all these different terms and angles, approaches, paradigms that people come up with. Fascism, you know, another thing. It's all part of communism, as far as I'm concerned. Different systems in controlled conflict with each other. When they're all at the mercy of the power elite bankers at the top. So, you know.
Okay, well, Philo, could you tell us who funded the Bolshevik Revolution?
My understanding is there's a lot of people have a lot better memory of the whole history of banking, which is the history of the world. History of the world, history of banking, pretty much the same thing. Anytime you read a history book that doesn't talk about banking in it, it's just, you can throw it out, because everything that's happened on this planet since the dawn of civilization is a result of bankers pushing their influence around to create wars. And, so, yeah, the Trotsky was basically given $5,000, which was a lot of money at the time, to go over to Russia and start drumming up support for this idea of called communism that Karl Marx came up with, which, as we know, is just a pipe dream system to be in controlled conflict with what we're calling capitalism. He got the Bolsheviks riled up to overthrow the Tsar, who obviously must not have been playing ball with the global elite bankers at the time. And they decided that he had to go. I guess Russia was on par, or if not ahead of the United States as far as technology. Airplanes, for example, industry in general was on par, if not more advanced, than the United States. And of course, it was all destroyed in the Bolshevik Revolution. All the owners of the companies were thrown out, killed, whatever. And then Western industrialists basically moved in under the reign of Lenin and later Stalin, and started building railroads, and Ford Motors, I guess, was real big in Russia. They were building Ford trucks, Ford cars in Russia. Anybody living in Russia throughout all this, or, you know, up in, like, for instance, Ayn Rand, a lot of people think, oh, you know, she's just so, she's just such a capitalist, you know. Well, she had to know what was going on, having grown up in the region and seeing who was behind all the industries there, and then coming here and then trying to tell people what capitalism is, and then, you know, propaganda, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, there were two books that both claimed that Wall Street funded the Bolsheviks. And I also posted in the chat room, if you guys are listening later on the podcast version, both of them are available from Amazon, obviously, as well as, you know, other booksellers. One of them is called Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, the remarkably true story of the American capitalists who financed the Russian communists. And again, that's Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. The other one is, of course, J. Edward Griffin's The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. And again, the name is The Creature from Jekyll Island. I mean, but yeah. So again, Philo, isn't that a bit strange that you have the Wall Street, which is supposedly capitalist, or allegedly so, financing a bunch of commies? How does that work?
Yeah, that what's strange is people write these books and they refer to the people that funded communism as capitalists. That shows you a disconnect. So people are just so conditioned to believe that communism is what Karl Marx says it is, and then capitalism is this supposed free market, you know, and that these industrialists are capitalists that funded communists. Communists fund communists, okay? They're communists. They're all communists. They know what's going on, that they have, as long as there is money, they have you by the balls. You don't understand how money works, and they do. They're in control, and it's kind of the thing is everybody has to play this game for it to work. Because like I say, if we don't have money, we're not going to have technology. So, we're just not going to be able to pool resources in an organized way to develop things like lenses for glasses, even, you know. I mean, that's what is driving this system that is ultimately potentially going to destroy us. Just our desire for new stuff, new technology. The industrialists, I mean, you can't really blame them for what they're doing because they're just playing a role. Somebody's got to do it. See what I'm saying? Because it's going to be there. So why shouldn't it be them? I'm sure that's how they rationalize what they're doing. I mean, it all starts with just somebody cracking a whip on somebody else in a production plant. You know, you got a guy working on the line, just starting out, and a manager cracking a whip, you know, faster, go faster every day. You know, that's where the bottom of the pyramid starts out and is, you know, and it just goes up from there until you have at the top the guys that all they do is own the money supply. That's all they got. And they are the richest people on the planet.
What is May Day? Would it be accurate to say that it's a communist holiday?
Every holiday is a communist holiday because we're on a giant commune. But that's why I sympathize with people that call themselves communists because they don't know what the hell's going on. They don't know that they're fighting the people that the so-called capitalists, you know, they're fighting for, workers' rights and better compensation and whatever for themselves as the people that are actually the only ones producing anything. You could argue, well, there's intellectual property, you know, which is ultimately what money is. It's just intellectual property that belongs to the banking elite. So these poor people calling themselves communists or communist too, maybe, they shoot themselves in the foot immediately because that, you know, maybe they get some better benefits or something if they all pull together and pick at a company. But then they go and say, you know, well, yeah, we're communists, but, you know, we got to have like seniority rules within our company. So if you're here for 5 years, you know, regardless of what you know, you may be working in a cabinet shop and you know everything about building cabinets. But if you start out at this company, you start on the bottom and at the lowest wage. And then after 5 years, you get a raise. And 10 years, you get a raise. You know, I mean, it's like that. See, they form a pyramid within their own operation right off the bat. And as soon as you form any kind of a tiered system, you know, boom, you end up with this huge pyramid with guys at the top running the planet, you know.
Right. Now, what would a world without... Now, I'm starting to think of a way to phrase this. would a world without money be a good thing? Because we constantly hear about, you know, money is the root of all evil, or how, you know, private banks, you know, basically control the issuance of currency and credit. So would just getting rid of money altogether, all forms of it, be better, so that therefore there is no instrument of trade, the common medium of trade, that can be seized by anybody?
Well, there are people that think that you could have a technologically advanced society, Jacques Fresca, and the whole Zeitgeist movement thing, I think, is they talk a lot about not having any money in the future. But the reality you're not going to have a technologically advanced culture without money. Like I say, unless some kind of supernatural force is that everybody's listening to is guiding the course of mankind. All these futuristic cities that Jacques Fresca paints and stuff. Yeah, that all sounds real good, but he talks about robots do all the labor, and I'm not saying he's not a sincere person, but that kind of we refer to it as a utopian-esque approach. You know, it does serve the power elite, because it gets people thinking about what just isn't real. The only thing that could might possibly work is if people just started really preparing right now, all throughout the whole world, for a complete collapse of our monetary system by using what technology we have now to build irrigation trenches throughout all the land to prepare for fields to be built and straw homes be built on these little plots of land where people are going to cultivate their food, and just, you know, try to go back to this totally simplistic agrarian, I guess you'd say, type of life.
Well, Philo, what is the Zeitgeist movement exactly?
Well, that's a good question. I've watched the movies, and it's I would sum it up as just people talking about a future where somehow everybody's equal and there's no money. But I mean, it's just entertainment, as far as ultimately what it boils down to is something that gives people a warm, fuzzy feeling, so they'll donate money to this to have guys talk about it.
But wait a minute, I thought they didn't want money. Well, what do you think the true political orientation is of TZM?
You just got to ask, you know, it's possible they're totally sincere about trying to come up with some kind of solution and not just trying to exploit people's desire for fluff or outright propagandists for the power elite, you know. I mean,
I've looked at a lot of their literature, you know, I've read their FAQs, and of course the link for that is in the chat room. For you guys listening later in the podcast version, you can find the TZM TZM FAQ at thezeitgeistmovement.com/FAQ. thezeitgeistmovement.com/FAQ. But you know, from what I could tell about where they're coming from, Philo, the closest political orientation I can label them as would be anarcho-communist, because they don't really fit anything else. They constantly talk about, you know, abolishing the state, but then on the other hand, you know, all the flying donut cities would be, each one would be centrally controlled by a bunch of benevolent scientist types or some such thing. And the communism part comes from, you know, we're going to go without money and everything's going to be communally owned. You won't have, oh yeah, they're going to abolish private property. I remember that one. And, you know, a bunch of other things as well. So that was the closest thing that, because obviously I study various anarchic schools of thought, and it's kind of interesting because as far as anarchy goes, which I've tackled in previous podcasts, it's very interesting. It's like the only thing they really agree on is abolishing the state, but then everything after that, you know, like they'll whine and bitch about whether or not hierarchy is good, bad, and different, whether we need it, not need, and all these other, like, well, arguably a lot of superfluous issues too, as well as some important details. But what I wanted to ask you, Philo, is, you know, wouldn't anarcho-communism be an oxymoron?
Yeah. Because, like I say, if you're going to have some kind of accounting tool, the power elite are going to be in control. Even monarchy, you know, I've been thinking about that this week after last week's show. In every monarchist system in the past, there was always a huge pool of slaves, and I've read accounts of history where somebody will try to say, oh, there was times like in England when things were so good, the time when they were building these cathedrals, these elaborate cathedrals that would cost, like, to duplicate one of these cathedrals today would be close to $1 billion, you know? And supposedly the story is everybody was so well off during these times that they just donated their time to sculpting these cathedrals. I mean, every single piece of this cathedral, they had to have just massive scaffolding everywhere all the time, moving around and stuff, and every piece has to be templated, and then somebody's got to extract the stone out of the quarry and come up with a rough shape, and then, you know, it goes up the line of craftsmen until it's shaped into the final piece, and the architects that design these things, and they've analyzed, you know, the designs, and everything within these cathedrals is like has something to do with some sacred geometry or something. It's just all the numbers are significant, and they're placed on ley lines and stuff that you have to have a satellite to line them up with. I'm not sure how they managed that, but back, you know, several hundred years ago. But and supposedly there's no slaves doing the majority of the work, you know.
Well, yeah, with communism, you know, as far as I understood it, necessarily required some form of the state in order to implement it. I.e., you need to have state-owned, ownership of factories and that kind of thing. So saying that you can somehow have anarchy and communism can't really – it's inherently a contradiction, because communism necessarily needs the coercive force of government to make it happen, because obviously then the big question is, well, how do you force, you know, dissenters? You know, every type of political structure always has to ask that question, which is how do you coercively force people to go along with whatever you're doing, whether that's a monarchy, a communism, a military junta, or even a form of the Night Watchman state such as the Republic. All of them have coercive nature inherent with all of them. Now, you know, you mentioned monarchy. Now, since monarchy and communism are both totalitarian, are they mutually supportive of each other or not? I mean, are they fundamentally, do you think that they're fundamentally different, or, you know, what do you think is going on there?
Well, I think in the past, a monarchy basically was structured so that you had people, people with swords and armor oppressing the people that are growing the food and manufacturing the clothing and the necessities of life, basically. You're just basically extorting the labor to build the castles and provide the food for the extortionists and the clothing, and then in communism, what we're experiencing now is they're not like forcibly extorting, so to speak, so much as just brainwashing people into giving the vast majority of what they produce to through a scientific creation of controlled opposition, controlled conflict, creating the illusion that people have choice, that people have representation, which is what part of communism is always creating the illusion that people have choice and representation, because the common man can see there's two parties generally in conflict with each other, you know. And if you look at the Revolutionary War, you know, the Tories and the colonists, the red coats and the blue coats, you know, I mean, it's the same thing we got now, red versus blue. This is not new, you know. This goes back arguably to the beginning of civilization, is certain people realized that, you know, you can really snow other people by first creating an accounting tool and then creating the illusion that they're being represented by somebody with controlled opposition. And the accounting tool itself is a controlled opposition entity. You know, it's got a debit and a credit. That's what makes a dollar. Two opposing forces that the piece of paper is just a piece of paper until I get somebody, if I'm the banker, to borrow it from me, and they in turn can purchase something from somebody, and now there's a debt established between the borrower and the person that sold the borrower something. That's actually the lender, and now I get confusing because we literally don't have the language to really explain this to people.
Speaking of that confusion, you know, earlier you mentioned about controlled opposition. Could you please define for the listeners what that is?
Well, it's two opposing forces that are actually the same thing. Like a battery has is one thing. It's got a plus side and a negative side. And a magnet has, you know, on one end it's got a pushing force, and the other end's got a pulling force. And so it can appear to be two things, but it's really one thing. And so when it comes to political parties, what they are opposing each other on is how much wealth is going to be redistributed, or how progressive is the tax going to be? Is it going to be more progressive, like some people want it to be, the Democrats in general? Or is it going to be less progressive, like the Republicans want it to be? More versus less, plus versus minus. So
Philo, how do the bankers use controlled opposition in their favor?
Well, it's... They're trying to just create a world... They're trying to create stability, okay? Because they own the cash supply, and there's endless amounts of resources to be extracted by owning the cash supply. But you have to maintain a stable society in order to keep this going. So in order to have stability, you have to have order, and order comes out of constant chaos. So this constant conflict that man is going through, it, basically being divided against himself. You know, all these wars are poor people killing each other. We're poor people extracting the natural resources to build weapons to kill each other with, while these bankers just sit in their mansions and offshore on their yachts, watching the poor people not only take care of them, but extract natural resources to build weapons to kill each other. You know, that's what throughout history that they're responsible for. You know, it's hard to say if it's just not a machine, that a system that is just people fall into place in and perform a role, like creating a new religion or something, to be in opposition to another religion, so that you can have people warring and killing each other over religion, or you know, a political system, political ideology against another political ideology, when it's all the bankers sitting at the top pulling everybody's strings, to what extent that man actually plans all this out, I kind of question more every day whether it's, you know, if it's just not a system that people just find a role in and then play their role, like in the Matrix, you know?
Well, speaking of the Matrix, could you give us some examples of predictive programming elements that symbolize the bankers, especially in fiction?
Well, my understanding with the Matrix is that they actually had a bunch of overt references to the Federal Reserve that they took out of the original script because it was just too overt. But Yeah, basically the guys that wrote that, they figured out what's going on. And, you know, and like that whole thing, Morpheus was talking to Neo about human beings being batteries. He didn't really elaborate on the significance of that, but, you know, we are basically polarized creatures, being drawn to one side or the other of this political system, one party or the other, generally, when it's just actually one party, and then being the energy cells for the power elite to continue doing what they're doing, because, you know, we're the ones that build everything and basically give it to them, you know. And then that whole thing with the take the blue pill or the red pill, you know, that was kind of misleading, because supposedly the red pill took you out of the Matrix, right? But I think the point is that we're not out of the Matrix. There's no way to get out of the Matrix unless you go back to living like an Indian, you know?
Well, yeah, and I think there's also other examples of, especially movies. You know, there's The Wizard of Oz, you know, a little man behind the curtain.
That totally, there's so many. Well, the guy that wrote the movie was the son of an industrialist. I think he was in railroads or oil. But I have a feeling that that guy overheard Frank L. Baum, or L. Frank Baum. Anyway, I think he overheard his dad talking to other industrialists about what was going to be going on over in Russia, because that was in the late 1800s, right after, you know, the Communist Manifesto came out in 1850 or 1860. And so I think this whole plan was developing to turn Russia into the so-called communism, and the East versus the West. So L. Frank Baum is sitting there thinking, man, I can't really expose, even if I tried to write down everything I'm hearing about what these guys are planning, there's no way it would get out. Everything I wrote would be destroyed. They'd track it down. So why not create an allegory, you know, a children's fable, allegory of, you know, these wicked witches of the East and the West fighting each other in opposition. And then incorporate the whole gold standard ideology with the yellow brick road, and then versus the silver standard, which were the ruby slippers were actually silver in the story. Just a lot of symbolism as far as the very policy, Emerald City, the Wizard of Oz. Oz is short for ounce. For example, emerald being the color of money, generally throughout history, I think. And then I don't know if there was a rainbow in the story off the top of my head, if there was actually, but interestingly, the guy that wrote the song for the movie was a guy that I guess he got hurt pretty bad in the Depression, and as far financially speaking. And I think he knew something about the monetary system anyway, and the Communist Manifesto, and the way guys like Karl Marx play with words. For instance, the first line of the Communist Manifesto is, "A specter is haunting Europe." And if you understand the type of guy Karl Marx was and how it's all about wordplay, and that communism is actually a spectrum of different systems in conflict with each other, I think the guy that wrote the song, he was a member of a socialist party in the United States, by the way. But I think he was kind of aware of what was going on, so he thought it would be cute to write this song, "Somewhere Over the Rainbow," about a fantasy world where that isn't communism, somewhere over the spectrum, that we're in. We're trapped in this spectrum or matrix. And and I think Pink Floyd knew what the hell was going on, because they, I don't know if you've ever watched the how they line up the movie Wizard of Oz with the album Dark Side of the Moon, or it's an album with a prism on it and a spectrum coming out of the prism. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I believe so. And there's also other movies as well. Like, for example, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. There's that scene where Harry, Ron, and Hermione are sneaking into the ministry, or that section of it, and it's basically this vault, if you will. And you essentially have what I think are like goblins or gremlins or whatever type of creature it was, with the hook nose and the, pointed ears. Basically, they're acting like bankers.
Yeah. Yeah, Hollywood is totally knows what's going on, and it's, this is all a big joke, and they're just playing a role, exploiting what they can.
Actually, came to, also another one that comes to mind too is Battlefield Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole concept of these aliens that speak a different language, that for the Earth to exploit the gold and take it back to their planet, and a human figures out how to learn their language and the only way you can learn it is by it being electronically transmitted in your mind, and which makes me wonder if the power elite doesn't actually have telepathic ability, to communicate eidetically, with imagery, as opposed to words. If I could just transmit a picture into your mind, you'd obviously understand where I'm coming from a lot better than me trying to explain it to you in words, and that's really the problem with people, is they're not looking at the world, actually watching people work and what they produce, where it goes. They're just thinking in terms of, This guy got paid money to do this, and then this guy got paid money to do this, and this guy invested over here, and because of his investments, he's making money. It's like, no, things are being produced, and they're ending up in other people's hands that don't produce anything. if we could just visualize that, And then, so Battlefield Earth, it ends up the humans defeat the bankers, and one of the bankers is trapped in a vault full of gold. You know, so the guy that wrote that, forget his name, but I think he knew what was going on, and he was basically, I don't know if he was actually, if he was just trying to exploit his knowledge of what was going on, or if he was actually associated with the power elite and a propagandist of some sort to basically create another religion, Scientology, just for the sake of, you know, the more different religions there are out there, the more chaos there's going to be, the more conflict. You know, I don't know if he was consciously doing that or...
Are communism and corporatism essentially the same thing, or are they fundamentally dissimilar? I mean, for example, we see, you know, the United States, which is supposedly a capitalist country, you know, doing lots of trade with China, which is a communist country. So are communism and corporatism, what's their relationship?
Same thing. It's all the same. That's one of the reasons I kind of concluded that, oh, you can't have money, is my latest interactions with some investors, not real high level guys, but, you know, they got a blog and anybody can go on it and lay down some comments, get reactions. And that's how I, you know, developed everything I, you know, my whole school of thought, the physics of money and, you know, the manipulation of language and everything, is constantly talking to people and bouncing ideas off of people on different blogs. And what these guys were talking about was their plan to go into Nevada on a Hopi land and extract the potash. And their attitude is, we're giving economic opportunities to the Hopis. You know, it's their land. They own the potash, but these investors are giving them economic opportunities, you know. And so I laid down a comment that, you know, you're more successful than most in this communist world. You've managed to become more successful. I forget the exact wording, but something to the effect that, congratulations, you know, you're in a communist world and you've made a lot of money for yourself, and you're going golfing two or three times a week while your investments pay for this, you know. And this is communism, you know. You did this because of communism. You're where you're at because of communism, because that's what this is. A private bank owns the cash supply, so there is nothing free market about this system. And you can't argue that there's anything free market about this system. And that's why we're so screwed up, is because you got this attitude that because you were like excessively aggressive throughout your life, and you're really not any more intelligent than anybody else, but you've managed to amass a portfolio that you can, you know, push around and trade for other. Push your stocks around, trade them for other stocks, and basically create forces to extract natural resources, the equipment and intelligence and everything to use the equipment and know where the resources are. But you know, you can't say that you're doing this under a free market system, and that you're, you know.
Well, Philo, are you telling us that America is currently a communist country?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, if that is the case, then what is the yardstick do you think that this can be measured and thereby proven?
The main two things are the privately owned cash supply. You can't argue that's free market. And the fact that we have a progressive tax. Because if we didn't have a progressive tax, it would be a totally different system. Those are two different systems. I know it's kind of hard to fathom. Why would that be such a big deal? But the fact is that a system without a progressive tax is one thing. A system with a progressive tax is a totally different thing. And we will never have a flat tax in this country because everything would collapse. That's part of the dichotomy that this communist system is having a progressive tax.
Well, as far as yardsticks go, you know, I was also kind of thinking about perhaps the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto, that document of which you referred to earlier, might be a good yardstick. And for the benefit of the listeners, I would like to read the 10 planks. Number one, the abolition of private property and the application of all rents to land to public purposes. Number two, a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. Number three, the abolishment of all rights of inheritance. Number four, the confiscation of the property of all emigrants and rebels. Number five, the centralization of credit in the hands of the state and by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. Number six, centralization of the means of communication and transportation in the hands of the state. Number seven, the extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state, the bringing into cultivation of wastelands, and the improvement of the soil generally in accordance with a common plan. Number eight, the equal liability of all to labor. The establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. Number nine, the combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries, the gradual abolition of the distinction between town and country by a more equitable distribution of population over the country. Number 10, the free education of all children in public schools, the abolition of children's factory labor in its present form, and the combination of education with industrial production. And again, those are the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. Now, Philo, if you don't mind, I would like to go through each of those and see if we can actually see if and prove it, using the 10 planks as a yardstick, that communism is indeed here in America. So let's look at – well, let's take the easy ones first. Number two, a heavy progressive or graduated income tax.
Well, that's the thing. Marx didn't write it so you could just like easily conclude that just because you have a progressive tax, you are in a communist country. He was a word player. If you keep this in mind when you read everything he wrote, and just kind of like pay special attention to terms regarding scales of things, then you kind of see, oh yeah, because what he wrote there is a heavy progressive tax. He didn't write a progressive tax, period. That's because he knew that once you introduce a progressive tax, you've crossed the line into communism. Now you have controlled conflict, controlled opposition over how progressive the tax is going to be. You couldn't have controlled opposition if it's a flat tax. Everybody would be united. Low taxes for everybody, because everybody pays the same percentage. There would be no, we have to have a party representing the poor, we have to have a party representing the rich, you know, because that all depends on if people are paying a different percentage of taxes. So, flat tax, you'd have everybody united, or we all just want to pay low taxes, minimal taxes for everybody united. You can't have unity in communism. Unity does not work. But the first, and then the first plank, he says, abolition of all rents, or did you want to read that?
Of course. And again, this is good for also for the listeners, especially if they don't know anything about communism, because this was also supposed to be a basic introduction to that as well. Yes, the first plank is the abolition of private property and the application of all rents of land to public purposes.
Yeah. So, well, right before the 10 planks, he says, nevertheless, in the most advanced countries, the following would be pretty generally applicable. Advanced. That's one of those terms that has to do with a scale, you know, that I was talking about. But, yeah, expropriation of property and land and application of all rents to land to public purposes. Now, what we have here is a public cash supply that is owned by a private entity and essentially being rented out. That is the basis of the power of the bankers. Is they simply, just if we, for simplicity, if we imagine every dollar was actually a physical note, they own those notes. You might have some of them in your pocket for a while, or some of them in your bank account for a while, but the only reason you have those is because somebody borrowed them from a banker, and they ended up in your pocket for a while, or your bank account, and they're renting those pieces of paper out. Usury. So,
right. But there's also the fifth plank that talks about the centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. I gotta say, that sounds like the Federal Reserve perfectly.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. Carl knows that you can't have money without a private entity controlling it. You can't have banks, period, without a private entity controlling them. There's just no way that the system that I came up with would be the most logical conclusion that anybody could come up with for introducing cash into society not controlled by a private entity. And then I realized that it just wouldn't work. And I think Karl Marx knows that it won't work. You just can't have money without private bankers controlling everything. So he's propagating the idea of there being a bank at all. You know, it when you say a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly, you're not saying no bank. You know what I'm saying, Sam?
Yes, I think so. Also, I think another of the easy ones is plank number 10 that talks about the free education of all children in public schools. And, you know, I got to say, I mean, we have public schools that are basically brainwashing. They're government indoctrination centers. I mean, that's what they are. You know, they keep, you know, and, you know, God forbid you should not, you know, walk where they tell you to walk, because then you're evil or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, at least with those easy ones, number two, the one about heavy regressive or graduated income tax, number five about the centralization of credit, and the thing with the national bank, and number 10 about public schools, I think those three are easily provable. But then, of course, there's the other seven. So let's start at the beginning with number one about abolition of private property and the application of all rents. Technically, now there's the issue about owning land. It's interesting, you know, even the Constitution mentions about eminent domain. Now, that's a very interesting concept. Apparently, what was based on is that we don't have a lodeal or even a lodium title available, at least from what I currently understand, unless there's some sort of way of getting that, of either having a lodeal or a lodium title to get to own land. What we have instead is this horrid fee simple system where basically if the government at any, you know, size or scale or scope or what have you decide that they want to, you know, your property happens to be in the way of their next expressway or, you know, lovely subdivision or whatever the current, you know, collectivist project is, you know, they can basically kick you out. And yeah, I mean, sometimes people will say stuff about, oh, well, they have to follow certain rules while they have to kick you out, such as have to compensate you for the land for fair market value, whatever the case is. But, you know, obviously, if it was a if that piece of property is an heirloom, if your family's been in your, you know, tree for generations, then, you know, even if you get fair market value, you know, that's a big joke because you can't replace a sentimental value. Also, it's kind of interesting, too, that fair market value, well, that's based on the currency again. So obviously, if the currency is being corrupted or it's being inflated or deflated or otherwise fucked with, you know, wow, you just lost your tangible assets of positive value, the land, the building, and the stuff on it, for this liquid form of wealth that's based on debt and a few other things as well. You know, it's just, well, hell, I'd rather have the land and the tools and, you know, the rest of that, because that's much more valuable to me. And, you know, that's the other thing, too, is property taxes. We got nasty property taxes here in Texas. But even in the other states of the union, you know, usually you pay property taxes, and a lot of times that'll go to fund those public schools, which are that 10th plank of the manifesto. So, I mean, you know, people claim about, oh, I'm a homeowner. Oh, I own my own home. Really? Like, even, okay, I mean, like, for guys who have mortgages, I mean, obviously you don't, because you're basically renting to own is the short version, because they charge you interest on your mortgage. But let's assume you pay off your 30-year mortgage. Do you really own that place?
No, we're totally at the mercy of, I mean, it's pretty dismal. I mean, I will always strive to educate people what's going on, and but at the same time, it's like if everybody knew at once, it would just be utter chaos, you know?
Right. Well, look at number three too, the abolition of all rights of inheritance. Now, this is interesting. You know, a lot of us are familiar with the inheritance taxes or various versions of that. I think it's known colloquially as the death tax. Pretty much, you know, if you know, a family member dies and they try and leave you stuff, generally speaking, there's always some sort of government requirement somewhere that you have to give them a certain percentage. They can forcibly extract from your recently deceased relative's wealth before it even passes on to you. So, for example, if you were left with $100,000, you know, they're supposed to get anywhere between a quarter to 35% of that.
Well, you got to try to get in the mind of Karl Marx, because what he's thinking about is what would life be like if there was no money and no bankers.
But wait a minute, I thought that's what the Zeitgeist Movement people were about. World without money?
Yeah. That's not what Karl Marx wanted. I'm not saying that's what he wanted. But see, he's a big picture kind of guy. He's writing from a perspective of, you know, somebody that sits there and spends hour upon hour, day upon day, week upon week, just thinking about shit, you know? And so he's got a picture of in his mind of what the world would be like without money. And you know, if there was no money, if there was no bankers, there would be no money to inherit. So, in a way, you know, he's kind of like throwing it in your face right there. You know?
Well, of course, you know, and also going on to, you know, plank four about the confiscation of the property of immigrants and rebels. Well, at least in terms of rebels, at the very least, I mean, look what the IRS does if you don't pay up your taxes pursuant to plank two. You know, in plank four, I mean, we've always heard about, you know, you're a tax resister, you're a tax rebel. How dare you need to pay your taxes? That's your fair share. We've always heard this. So, of course, I mean, look at the – I mean, guys, when you get a chance, go look up the various multifaceted, voluminous IRS publications. They explicitly tell you how all that works. You know, there are certain tyrants in history, guys, that don't have the balls to put that kind of stuff on paper – but yet the criminal rebel government and its various sub-entities do that.
Yeah, I don't know if you were taught how to do your taxes in high school. I remember a class, everybody had to take taxes. And, you know, it's like indoctrination, you know, right off the bat. They just explain it, you know, the more you earn, the higher percentage of taxes you're going to have to pay. Don't ask us why, but, you know, just be a diligent taxpayer. We'll teach you how to fill out your tax form, even though it's just so freaking convoluted, nonsensical. That's the way the world works. And,
right. Now, obviously, Plank 5 dealt with the National Bank, so we'll go on to number 6, which is about the centralization of communications and transportation. Well, I think that one – actually, I probably should have covered this a little bit earlier. I think that one's easily provable, too. Correct me if you think I'm wrong on this one, Philo. Look at the administrative agencies. Look at the FCC for comms. Look at all the systems of censorship and surveillance. Look all on the transportation side. Hell, let's do an easy one. How about TSA? You know, how about any of these, you know, administrative agencies that are absolutely dictatorial asswipes, just like the IRS and others? Again, with transportation and communications, I mean, maybe it's not, I mean, maybe we still, there still exists a private or corporate version of it, but you have to admit they're regulated within an inch of their life with both.
Well, yeah,
I mean, you can't even be part of the mainstream media, even a basic like something like on the AM frequencies or sometimes even shortwave, without getting a fucking FCC license. You have to ask these administrative agencies for permission to engage in something where which would otherwise be considered criminal. You know, they call it pirate radio.
Yeah, but keep in mind, if there was no money, if there was no banks, there would be no centralized transport in the first place. It just wouldn't get coordinated to be done. So that by that reasoning, they already own it anyway. I mean, that I'm sure that's how they rationalize anyway.
Right. Going on to Plank 7 about the extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the government and improving the soil in accordance with the common plan. Now, this one might not be as easily provable, so if someone can prove it conclusively, we can definitely re-examine that at a later time. What I will say is, again, look at the administrative agencies. I would say Bureau of Land Management would be kind of a key one, BLM. Definitely, or, you know, also, I don't, this might be stretching a little bit, but I think maybe looking at the nature of corporations and how they just absolutely, as legal artificial entities, have just completely spun out of control, or at least the ones that are, how do they call them, too big to fail?
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to show if you want to make it in this world, if you want to have a high standard of living, you've got to play the game.
Yeah.
Exploiting other people.
Yeah, and that's not right. I mean that would violate. It would make sense why some people would become conscientious objectors to that, because they don't want to forcibly exploit or otherwise harm other people.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Unfortunately, it means that if you really don't want to exploit other people, you're just going to be working on a production line basically your whole life. I mean,
or some other kind of measly drudgery type of work. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause even if you start your own business, you're going to have to hire somebody and crack a whip on them.
Yeah. <know? laughs> Going on to Plank 8 about the equal liability of all to labor. Well, probably the singular best proof of this, if there is one, would be the fact that absolutely everybody that has a legal person has a Social Security number. I mean, that SSN really binds us to the system like nothing else does. So if someone's going to make – if you're going to make the overall claim about America being a communist country, and if – the 10 planks are the best yardstick, and that is a big if. Then for Plank 8, yeah, Social Security number, man, that thing is atrocious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, people argue, you know, someday there's going to be a mark of the beast, you know?
What are you talking about? What are you talking about? It's here already.
I know. I'm a Christian, but, man, nothing drives me crazier than hanging around with other Christians.
I understand where you're coming from, and obviously I'm not a Christian, but you know, I don't like any of this Big Brother creepy ass stuff either. I mean, this is just totally appalling. And by the way, we're not even getting into RFID chips yet, which is a topic which will be part of another broadcast in the future. But just even with the stuff that exists now, it's absurdly invasive. And so only an authoritarian or otherwise totalitarian structure would be so invasive like that. But yeah, equal, I believe, all labor? Shit, Social Security number. I mean, here's a good question, guys. Can you actually get a job without having to fill in that damn SSN? Or here's a fun experiment. Try getting a job without giving your SSN. I would love to hear, like, an example. Like, yes, I was able to get a good-paying job or something. A living wage, if you will. I was able to get a job that pays me $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year without giving an SSN. So, guys, you know, if you know of somebody, if you yourself did it, hit me up. I'd love to hear it. But I haven't heard anybody yet doing that. I mean, unless they figured out a way they're keeping it secret for OPSEC reasons or something, but that's the only reason I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way to really reason that we are not already just so screwed. I mean, it's a dismal way to look at things, but...
Let's look at number 9, combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries. The gradual abolition of the distinction between town and country by more equitable distribution of population over the country. Okay, if somebody thinks that's not accurate, they've got their head up their ass or in the sand. Dude, look at how much this country has urbanized. I mean, it says it like perfectly. Like, explicitly. I mean, how many people... I mean, I'm trying to remember the current population statistic, but I thought it was something crazy, like less than 10% or less than 5% of people live in rural areas, and only half of them are self-sufficient or some such thing. And, like, so it's like 90-plus some-odd percent of people are in urban and suburban areas. And suburban, and for all intents and purposes, suburban areas are the same as urban areas, except you have a little bit more, elbow room. And the reason I say that is because you're still depending on the same systems of support in terms of physical infrastructure. Yeah, you have to go to the grocery store to get your food. You have to buy their gasoline from Big Oil. You've got to use their government roads and on all those various similar characteristics. If you were self-sufficient in a rural area, you would at least have other options. But, here's the question. I mean, ask yourself this. Does most of the American population, can they, A, grow their own food so they completely feed themselves without going to a grocery store, or at least very seldom? B, are there alternate sources of power for cars, for your home and all that, that's not dependent on Big Oil? That is commonly used by Americans for the most part, or at least a quarter of them. And C, are there any, like, non-government roads anywhere that are private that are actually affordable to drive on? So, and you don't even need to look at only those. Look at all these other – look at the other aspects of the physical infrastructure and ask yourselves – is this kind of more typical, like in a rural setting, especially a more self-sufficient setting, like what the founders and people during the colonial era were used to? Or is this all like urbanized, high-tech, overly regulated type living space where people are crammed into stuff and it's so bad they actually have to build up instead of out?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, guys, but, anthropological studies and other types of well-done academic research papers and other things have proven that human beings need room. Not accounting for individual differences or anything like that, but generally speaking, as a universal truth, which so far seems to be accurate, holds up to history, human beings need space. Now, what degree of space, that's subjective. But you need space, so you cram people in too tightly. I mean, God, look at the various European cities in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, approximately. I mean, that was like pre-plumbing, pre-electricity for a lot of the time, anyway. How come the cities had greater rates of disease? Still do in a lot of cases, even with electricity implying. It's because you have so many people so close together. One guy catches a cold, then he has to go to school or work or whatever, or even just travel to his job. He comes in contact with people, and they spread just a basic cold around. We're not talking about, the Black Death, the plague, basically. We're not talking about Ebola or any of this other stuff, and I'm talking about the real diseases, not the make-believe H1N1 stuff or whatever version the establishment pushes this week. I'm just saying, look at something as simple as the quote-unquote common cold. That stuff passes, spreads faster than anything else when you have people that are close and together. I mean, even when you do take precautions, you sneeze into your arm or your hand, you wipe doorknobs or whatever. Even with all those, generally speaking, we have a lot of people closer together, one of them gets sick, and a lot of times if it's communicable, even, and sometimes even when it's not communicable, that can happen as well, especially considering that, you know, for various other reasons. And actually, that would be a subject for its own broadcast, because that can be obviously gone into the weeds as well. But the point is, human beings need space. But we have here in the Communist Manifesto, the 10 planks, you don't get to have your space, right? Because we need to work at factories, or actually our current version as a service economy is to go work in a fucking cubicle, or its equivalent. And think about that, too. I mean, you go back on history a while, and you have to imagine just how... Actually, you don't have to imagine. I mean, for a fact, you know, people, even 100 years ago, were... I mean, you got to understand how much like rawhide they were. There was a lot of running, jumping, riding, physical labor with, like, farming, lifting stuff. You know, it's just, I mean, a little, I guess you could, closest thing people understand is probably more Wild West, you know, sans the sexiness, at least a lot of the time. But consider what, you know, physical exertion is for us now. You know, we were lying down in bed, and then what happens? We get up and we sit. And then we go to work and we sit in the car, or we go to work by sitting in a car. And then we go to work, and a lot of times we sit. Maybe sometimes some people stand up and walk around or whatever, but generally speaking, we're sitting. Then we go back home in the car again, we're sitting. And then we go home and we sit, watch television, read, whatever. And then we're back and lying down. So it's basically walking a little bit, lying down whenever you're unconscious, and otherwise sitting. And it's just that cycle of that over and over and over again. So, you know, even in a service-based economy type stuff, you know, it's not exactly great either. And then notice, like, America has the highest rates of obesity. Well, how the fuck did that happen? You know, figure it the fuck out. And obviously, for more of the nutrition side, we'll get into that in a later broadcast. I'm just saying. Look at, you're not supposed to squish people together. It's unnatural. Cities are completely artificial. Alan Watt has talked about this too. So it's not just me in my little head. Sorry, I don't mean to get so persnickety, but I've had private conversations with people where they say the absolute stupidest things, Philo.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably one of my future focuses is going to be on health and diet and stuff like that, and survivalism, you know, preparedness. I'm gonna you know, be there for anybody that wants to delve into monetary policy issues, you know, to help them any way I can to ultimately figure out there can't be any money.
Well, if you want to get into, you know, being a survivalist, and I'll say this too for the benefit of the listeners, go back to episode 49, actually, which was entitled Survivalism, because that was a good basic introductory look at that. But, you know, getting, I know I didn't mean to get too so sidetracked, but or at least overly focused on that one point. But again, if you look down the 10 Planks of the Communist Manifesto, I mean, again, we've got property taxes, we've got the income tax, we've got the death tax, we have the IRS crazy regulations with stealing your stuff if you don't pay your taxes, we have the Federal Reserve, we've got all these administrative agencies with the Communications and Transportation, and two specifically are FCC and TSA. You know, we've got these nasty corporations as well as BLM. We've got Social Security numbers. We have increased urbanization in a huge, huge way. And that stuff doesn't happen by accident because you have to get permits and license from the state to even do developments and whatever, for at least a lot of the time. And then, of course, we have public schools. So maybe some of the proof is lacking maybe on a few of those planks. But for the most part, there's too many correlations with many of these planks. So, yeah, it would seem to be the case that America is indeed a communist country. It's just a different flavor of communism. I mean, some people have also said, oh, it's fascist.
It's the I think if you look at it, like communism one, and then there is the whole world, and then what we refer to as communism in Cuba and North Korea, that's communism too.
You know, yeah, again, it's a different flavor. Yeah, controlled opposition to the rest of it, right?
Yeah, what we're calling capitalism, just controlled opposition to what we're calling communism. It's all communist banker-run society because we use their money, and there's no frickin' way. If you know, the whole story about how money was created in the first place with the goldsmiths creating receipts for the gold and then people using the receipts, you'd have heard that.
I think it was also featured in Paul Grignon's Money is Debt cartoon. I think there was a section called The Goldsmith's Tale or something like that.
Yeah, that's really just as much gold standard propaganda as anything, because you don't need gold. All you need is a service, let alone a commodity of some sort, like arrowheads. Even if you just provide a service for somebody and say, look, we're not going to direct trade anything right now because you don't have anything I want, but I'll give you a token that you, I'll keep this token that you give me. You will make a token and then you give it to me, and then I can redeem this from you at a future date, or I can take this to our neighbor down the road. And you tell him that, you know, whenever I give him this token, he gives me his product, and then he'll redeem your product from you. And that's how we'll so we don't have to direct barter everything. See, now you can establish a fiat currency right there, a book entry currency, and the guy that figures out that, holy shit, I can, like, loan these tokens to somebody. After everybody's used to using these tokens, a shell with an engraving in it, for instance, then somebody figures out, I can loan these out to somebody and charge usury on them. I can just manufacture these in a regulated amount to, you know, gradually work my way up, to where everybody's just like really pooling resources to produce technology, and they're trading these tokens around with each other, and then I start loaning them out and charging usury, and eventually I don't have to produce anything. I just collect the usury on what this cash supply I've created. Yeah, I didn't have any gold to start with. I just figured out that you know, and anybody could have figured this out since the beginning of time. It's not some big secret that, you know, that somebody just invented within the past couple hundred years. You know, it's a law of nature that anybody could figure out from the beginning of time. You know,
right. So, you know, and obviously for the benefit of the listeners, I posted this in the chat room, but for you guys listening later on the podcast version, there's a book called The Anti-Terrorist Handbook by The Anti-Terrorist, who's the British chap on YouTube with the ski masks and sunglasses. He wrote a book, actually two books, but definitely in that first book he mentions about communism and a few other things. And subsequently, he also had a video which was called The Anti-Terrorist on the Communist Manifesto. And so, again, just go to YouTube, type in The Anti-Terrorist on the Communist Manifesto. So before we go to break, Philo, are there any books that you would recommend people read to learn more about communism and economics?
Well, I would just recommend that people look at, like, the Communist Manifesto and just keep in mind the wordplay that Karl Marx was using, and then like Plato's Republic, if you want to get an idea of how propaganda was being utilized 300 years BC, you know, and then, you know, like Diogenes is a contemporary philosopher to Plato, and he was the son of a banker. And he chose not to play the game, and he ended up living in a drain pipe or something, you know, because he had integrity. So he was not going to play the game. But I analyze a lot of like Latin dictionary and the dictionary in general, and just try to figure out the origin of the words we're using to communicate, you know, and because there's so much manipulation going on with our language. Like, you know, we use the terms buy and sell. We didn't use the term trade. So there's something different about a buy and a sell than a trade, you know. Well, the difference is there's a debt involved with a buy or a sell. That's why it's not a trade, you know. Why don't we look at it like that, you know? Why aren't we taught things like that? Because people would figure out, you know, that this whole game is creating an illusion of who the debt is with. That we're convinced the debt's with the banker when it's not, you know.
All right. Well, Philo, we need to go to a break for a few minutes. So for everybody listening, just go ahead, grab a cup of coffee, get something to eat, go to the bathroom, whatever you need to do, and we will be back momentarily. Okay, everyone, we are back from break for this podcast episode on communism. So obviously there's a lot of material to deal with just because of the nature of what it is, but now we're going to start getting into a little bit more of the problem-solving side, I guess you could say. Let us check back. Filer, are you with us? All right, it looks like you might have to wait a bit for him, or possibly go back, or possibly take elongate the break, I guess you could say. We'll just have to see. But something that definitely needs to be gone into is, and we pretty much have gone through now about this communist system, or if you prefer fascist or whatever. But the point is that it's authoritarian, okay? I mean, I mean, they really have, you know, got our, you know, the body politics balls in a vice grip, so to speak. So we really need to focus on problem solving to kind of gauge what needs to be done, then, of course, implement it. Let us check back. Finally, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't have my speakers on there.
Not a problem. Not a problem. That's when we go to take break, there's a reason. Yeah. You can only sit in a chair for so long because a lot of us are actually very active men. We actually have to get up and walk around and do stuff and whatever because we're trying to kind of bring back, or at least in our own lives, trying to live much like our ancestors did and trying to be as much as rawhide as possible. So, you know, Philo, let's start this second half with what are taxes?
Well, the general idea is that we contribute a percentage of our time to the common use infrastructure. And ideally, you know, everybody would contribute the same amount of time, regardless of what their ability to produce something is, you know. A small person obviously is not going to be as physically capable as a large person. So, you know, but they would contribute an hour of their time a day as a large person contributes an hour of time of their day for, like, constructing some kind of common use structure. And then, of course, there's always people in managerial positions directing other people what to do. But, and that's reasonable, right? But then we get into this whole system that very clever people develop, where because, like, you're way more productive than somebody else, you should contribute a larger percentage of your time than somebody that's not as productive. Now you have conflict over how much time should everybody contribute to the common use infrastructure. And that's ultimately the controlled opposition argument that our two main political parties have with each other. And they'll sit there and accuse each other of class warfare rhetoric when, it obviously takes two to have a war. So they're always constantly spouting class warfare rhetoric and then accusing each other of spouting class warfare rhetoric as if.
But again, that goes to the concept of controlled opposition, does it not?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. Well, here's the thing that kind of bugs me is, you know, we know that the Federal Reserve notes, the FRNs, are basically worthless. So why would the government desire worthless currency? What's going on there?
Well, we know they're not worthless because if you have any Federal Reserve notes in your pocket, I'd like to have them if they're worthless. You know, I mean, you're not going to, you know, you can go buy something in this large economy. You might not be able to buy as much as you would have the day before, and definitely not years before. You know, if somebody was to stick $100,000 under their mattress 70 years ago, or maybe not $100,000, just $10,000, you know, it's going to be, the purchasing power is going to be a fraction of what it was. But you know, that kind of plays into the whole illusion of what the problem with the money is. The problem is not that it's a fiat currency or that it's losing its purchasing power day by day. The problem with it is that it's owned by a private industry. That has got to be the main focus of anybody wanting to deal with monetary policy issues. Unfortunately, there's no way it's not going to be owned by a private industry. We've got to just approach life from the perspective that that this is not going to change unless something supernatural happens here.
Well, what I find interesting is, you know, the old libertarian axiom has always been that all taxation is theft.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, what's wrong with contributing to, if you're in an Indian village, you know, or I guess there's Indian villages to this day, you know, there's a good reason for everybody pulling together to, you know, develop a common use structure, for example.
Well, you know, the question comes up about, is it consensual? Are they freely contracting with each other, or do you have some warlord thuggish type using coercive force, i.e. at the barrel of a gun, so to speak, in libertarian parlance, at the barrel of a gun forcing other people to buy into his little protection racket?
Yeah, but, I mean, that's coming from the perspective of not just understanding that you're already screwed. You're just...
Well, okay, if we're screwed, then there's nothing... Well, if it's true that... Well, hold on a sec. Even if it's true that we're already screwed, then there's nothing voluntary or consensual about any of this. Like in the previous, on the previous segment before the break, when we were going through the planks, and there was the one about the confiscation of property of immigrants and rebels, and the best example we could find was with like the IRS doing it when people don't pay their taxes. Again, if I don't pay taxes, if what it's federal income or capital gains or whatever fucking version happens to be this week, then there is a good chance that whatever agents of the state are going to come and find me, i.e. create an excuse to steal even more of my wealth. They're either going to find me, imprison me, i.e. kidnap me, which people call arresting, kidnap me and throw me in a cage, so imprison me. Or they just come barreling through the door and they just kill everybody. So, I mean, that's happened before, too. I mean, look at Jose Guarnera. Not a tax resister case, to be fair, but in various other cases of police brutality or whatever, you know, some of them were tax resisters, other ones weren't, or in the case of Guarnera, it was actually they misidentified the wrong house. But whatever it is, I mean, this is not, you know, people, you know, I love it when some people would say, oh, it's patriot mythology that, you know, armored, you know, the militarized police kick your front door in. It's like they've done this many times already. What are you talking about in this mythology? So looking what's on the books, like in the terms of confiscating if somebody doesn't pay their taxes, we already have proof that they will create excuses to steal more of it. Those are the fines. We already have proof in a history of them kidnapping, i.e., you know, arresting, but kidnapping people and imprisoning them, throwing them in cages. And we also have proof of them just barreling through the front door and or the side door, wherever the infill and exfill points are, entrances and exits in civilian parlance, through the infill and exfill and base or whatever, and taking the targets out. And it's kind of a problem if you and your family are the targets, because that means it's your brain matter that's splattered on the wall behind you.
Right. And so, see, I'm trying to come up with what's my approach to life now that I've determined that we're so screwed and that you can't You can't have money or you're going to be screwed. And what we can do with the knowledge of if everybody... Now, I don't know if I'm the guy that's going to do this, but with the knowledge that I have exposed, for instance, with the physics of money, and that this is communism, there could be, like, you know how Mr. Mighty, is that his name, that talks about using language properly to get out of
Freeman on the land, Robert Arthur of the Menard family, and yes, his YouTube handle is Mr. Mighty.
Yeah. See, yeah, I recommend definitely learning like what somebody like that knows about dealing with the law, and then I know that there could be a system developed with using my stuff as a basis for not being affected by tax collectors and bankers. Basically, if they try to touch you, you're going to expose them to so much reality that they're not going to want to get anywhere near you.
Now it's funny you should mention that, because there's two main areas that the Free Man of the Land type people always have addressed, which is one of the more legal stuff, which is their main thing. And the secondary area, which they kind of dabble in, is the financial stuff, which I find interesting. And, you know, some of them will go into, you know, corporate Canada or whatever the case is. And, you know, other people will talk about accepted for value or other concepts that really are not, don't make any sense. And in the attempt to not be subject to, you know, commercial code, they use UCC or whatever the case is. So, I mean, obviously, considering the subject matter and the fact that it's absurdly complicated, that absolutely needs to be its own broadcast episode, at least for the introductory stuff. But for the benefit of the listeners, just so that you know who we're talking about, YouTube handle is Mr. Mighty, spelled MRMITTEE. Sorry, that's 1 T 2 E's. And I'll post a link in the chat room momentarily. But again, the URL is youtube.com/MRMITEE. And I think his website also is thinkfree.ca. Again, that is thinkfree.ca. But it's funny you should recommend that as an option, Philo.
Well, actually, a more practical approach, it seems to me, is Randy Kelton and the Rule of Law Radio approach. You know what I'm talking about? And then there's another guy. Anyway, I've been planning on getting into that a lot, but this whole monetary reform issue just has totally consumed the past over 3 years of my life now. But I had to do it, you know, just to say that, you know, I've probably got a broader understanding of every monetary approach out there than any single person has on this planet. You know, I mean, a lot of people can really elaborate on one specific approach way longer than I can, you know, but they don't even know anything about other people's approaches, you know, whereas I pretty much analyzed every approach out there. So I can give anybody a really, you know, summation about every monetary approach. But, yeah, just learning how to, you know, explain to people that the bank didn't loan you anything in the first place. So how can they foreclose on your home, you know? And if you knew how to argue this in front of a judge, you know, they're just eventually they're going to just say, you know what? We don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. We got, you know, easier fish to fry, type of thing, you know, and that's about all we can do, you know. I mean, I don't know if anything's going to change unless the monetary system just completely falls apart. You know, there's talk about maybe free energy technology, you know, would possibly just change everything, you know. Maybe, yeah. I recently watched a video about a guy that was working on the technology, and he was approached by the Men in Black or whoever, you know, and they said specifically to him, you are threatening the monetary system of the United States of America, and you have to cease and desist your work. And you're not going to associate with anybody that you've been working with either, you know. And he didn't know why they said monetary system, you know. What, you know?
Right, yeah. Right. And I was also putting a few links in the chat room. And actually, there was a problem with the Think Free site. So for everybody listening, instead go to the World Freeman Society, which is another one of Robert Arthur Menard's sites. That's located at worldfreemansociety.org. Again, that is worldfreemansociety.org. So, continuing on, Philo, what are legal tender statutes?
I can't cite them or anything, but I can tell you that they're just pretty much a bunch of bullshit just to convolute our whole understanding of money and the fact that it's a private bank owning it, you know. They own the money, you know. It's yours to use as an accounting tool for a while, you know, here and there. Everybody's pretty much using it all the time, unless you're just doing nothing but barter. But they own it, and they're making usury on it. Every penny in everybody's pocket, somebody's actually paying interest on it. It's hard to fathom how somebody, if you got a $10 bill in your pocket, somebody is paying interest on that $10 bill in your pocket. Yes, that's why they're so rich.
Well, it's kind of interesting too, because the legal tender statutes, from my understanding of it at least, force us to accept the Federal Reserve notes in payment of debt, and so it is by definition fiat. You know, there's nothing voluntary about any of this. So if I'm selling, you know, if I'm selling a bunch of clothes and one of my customers hands me an FRN, I have to accept that. If I refuse, then government agents can come and harass me, throw me in prison, do whatever they want with me for the most part.
Yeah, that's pretty screwed up. Yeah, you know, a lot of people say, well, we should use gold for money. You know, that is money. That's, you know, and all. The thing is gold can be turned into a debt instrument, just like a piece of paper can, okay? Just because it's a gold coin, if you're borrowing it from a banker, it's a dead instrument, and you could have used paper. It's you turn that gold coin into an IOU. And the banker is still running your life. And so the only way that that gold would reasonably be used as money is if it was just a barter tool like any other commodity. But the thing is in a barter society, people want like food and clothes and shelter mainly. So gold is not even going to really be that, you know, play that much of a role in a barter society, you know. It's going to be either you're going to have, you know, these book entry IOUs of some sort and technology being developed, or you're just going to be living an extremely simple life with no technology, you know.
Right. And it's I mean, that's just atrocious. And what's interesting too, Philo, is like anybody can look up, and I posted this in the chat room, and then if you guys are listening later on the podcast version, do a search for 31 USC 5103. Again, that is Title 31, United States Code, subsection 5103, which is about legal tender. And it will tell you, United States coin and currency, including Federal Reserve notes and circulating notes of Federal Reserve banks and national banks, are legal tender for all debts, public charges, taxes, and dues. Foreign gold or silver coins are not legal tender for debts. But then, of course, you combine this with the other, you know, statutes on the books, which do require more investigation because, well, it's a little bit involved, and it's not something you can find with an easy internet search, to be honest. But it is compulsory. You know, again, another link also in the chat room. But if you guys listening later, go to Wikipedia, which I try not to recommend. But go to History of the United States Dollar, History of the United States Dollar, and the subsection on fiat standard. And what it says is that today, like the currency of most nations, the dollar is fiat money. It's unbacked by any physical asset. The holder of Federal Reserve note has no right to demand an asset such as gold or silver from the government exchange for a note. And then it goes on about the intrinsic theory of value. So, I mean, Philo, I don't know where this claim is. And here's the other thing, too, is that taxes wouldn't have so much of a bite if the currency that they want to be paid in wasn't fiat. And see that's another conundrum on top of it, because technically the government doesn't even need taxes. You know, there was actually an article by Beardsley Rummel that was published in American Affairs in 1946. It was titled "Taxes for Revenue Are Obsolete." Again, that is "Taxes for Revenue Are Obsolete," and these brief two paragraphs are from Edwards' book, Creature from Jekyll Island. The first paragraph says, and obviously this is used under the sincere intention of fair use, quote, "His thesis is that given control of a central banking system and an incontrovertible currency, that is a currency not backed by gold, a sovereign national government is finally free of money worries and needs no longer to levy taxes for the purpose of providing itself with revenue. All taxation, therefore, should be regarded from the point of view of social and economic consequences." And it goes on, quote, "The dollars the government spends become purchasing power in the hands of the people who have received them. The dollars the government takes by taxes cannot be spent by the people, and therefore these dollars can no longer be used to acquire the things which are available for sale. Taxation is, therefore, an instrument of first importance in the administration of any fiscal or monetary policy." And so, and then J.R. Griffin kind of goes on and more or less makes what I think is a good argument, that taxation now is an instrument of social engineering. So, I mean, you compare that. Now, if that's true, you then compare that with those proportions of the planks, especially heavy progressive income tax, and the domino effect of all of that. Assuming all those things line up neatly, what we're looking at is a very nasty, tyrannical picture.
Well, that's what I'm trying to tell you. I'm trying to, like, do it as smoothly as possible without, you know, because lately I've just been having an extremely hard time accepting the reality that I am starting to see. And, you know, realize that I need to change the focus of my life to have any purpose in it, you know. I mean, that, you know, G. Edward Griffin and the guy you just read from, I mean, their understanding of monetary policy, I mean, they can write and write and write and elaborate on certain concepts forever and come up with huge volumes, but I mean, their understanding of why a piece of paper with a dollar sign on it, that little squiggle with the line through it, which means debt, that's a symbol of debt, why that piece of paper is worth anything in the first place and why we use it in our commerce, I mean, it is so rudimentary, you know, because the fact is if you think about it long enough, you're going to conclude that there just can't be money, or you're going to have private bankers running your life, period. That's all there is to it.
Right, and you know, there's also another Wikipedia page that's entitled "Non-Tax Revenue." Again, that is non-tax revenue, and it's interesting. So, even if the government needed taxes, let me rephrase that. Even if they needed a source of revenue, there are non-tax sources of it, and technically, this list on this Wikipedia page, you could actually condense it into three main sources. The first one would be, of course, investment dividends.
Yeah, well, this is the CAFR, what I've named the CAFRism.
Yes, and for the listeners, CAFRs are comprehensive annual financial reports.
Yeah, the guy that's heading that up,
Burian.
Walter Burian. This is the basis, what you're talking about, of his approach is he's trying to come up with a solution to making the slaves' lives a little easier by pointing out all these assets or this portfolio that the government owns. You know, I hate to use the word assets because an asset can become worthless real fast if people realize.
Exactly. And then there's the race the teller's cage, and then it's not so hip and cool anymore, right? Well, I mean, like, of the non-tax revenue. Okay, so the first is the investment dividends. And then there's the second main source, what I like to call the nationalized businesses. What I mean by that is, you know, consider, I mean, the electric grid. Oh, actually, come to think of it, I know this is going slightly on tangent, but I'm actually referring to a previous thing. Earlier when I mentioned about the physical infrastructure, one of the things I forgot about was the electric grid. That's another proof of more urbanization, is the fact that you actually have to have electrical grids instead of people in rural areas or wherever, each unit being self-sustaining or otherwise able to take care, or otherwise being self-sufficient. In this context, though, with the non-tax revenue, the nationalized businesses, again, the power grid, like the utility companies, you know, how many private or even corporate, if you want to, you know, compromise on it, you know, what non-governmental utility companies exist. I mean, everywhere I've ever lived, I've had to pay utilities to usually the city or municipality wherever I am.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of a big deal. So there are, and that's just one example. There's other types of, you know, I guess you could call them nationalized businesses, except nobody calls it by that, but something that everybody uses. The third major area for the non-tax revenue are basically voluntary contributions. I mean, literally, I mean, believe it or not, guys, despite the horrendous taxes and, you know, the machinations of creating the currency or whatever, there are still people that literally throw their wealth at the state. I mean, it's basically the equivalent of giving, you know, of pitying the state and get where, I shouldn't put it that way, but it's essentially equivalent to, you know, throwing, you know, a couple coins or whatever at a beggar. And here's the funny thing, you know, if we actually had a properly functioning republic, you know, I mean, the state would still get funded. Because some people would say, oh, well, I think you're doing a nice job with this one other thing or that other thing or whatever, and say, oh, I feel so sorry for you, government. Here, have a little bit of money so you guys can have desks and chairs or something. You know, that's when you know you've got a greater, a proper minarchist government, is when people start taking pity on the government and start voluntarily giving them a little bit of money. And the big joke is that everyone is a lot wealthier than they would have been otherwise. But of course, that's not the case with what we're dealing now, is it?
No, because anytime you talk about giving the government money, you're talking about something that is owned by a private bank, and they're going to be in control of the planet.
Right. Well, let's getting on to more strictly on the problem-solving stuff, what I like to think is the happier things, like, how can we resist tyranny? Yeah, you know, and then people get excited or whatever. Yes, that was my lame attempt at a joke for tonight. Anyway, Philo, what are local alternative currencies?
They're just, I hate to say it, but it's a real vain attempt to try to remedy a situation when ultimately it's the guy that started a currency in the first place that should have been shot. You know what I mean? If you analyze the people's approach that are starting alternative currencies and their understanding of monetary physics, it's pretty abysmal, you know, that the main idea is that they're creating a debt-free currency, and they're saying that we're going to issue people currency, and the only stipulation is that you don't have to pay it back ever, but you have to accept it in your commerce. But there's no debt. There's no debt here. Nobody's in anybody's debt. We'll give you $40 worth of currency, and you just accept the, you just go out and spend it, and then you accept it for whatever you produce, and there's no debt. And that's ridiculous, because of course there's a debt. And the only reason it works is because people have a conscience that tells them, if I can buy something for these $40 worth of paper, then I in turn have to produce something, you know, that's pretty much equivalent to at least to whatever I bought in exchange for 40 pieces of paper, assuming they're denominated in that way. A dollar per piece of paper, you know, the community currency denominates in terms of hours, tenths of an hour, half an hour, generally equaling $10, to try to keep it simple. You know, in the case of a currency collapse of the Federal Reserve note, which could happen for a few different reasons, that it would be good to have a community currency established to kind of keep things rolling somewhat. As far as a long-term solution, see, my approach to monetary policy on a national scale was basically modeled on the community currency model, except there would be an official, you're issued $1,000 and you sign a promissory obligation for $1,000. Because that's all a bank is doing, is they're issuing you pieces of paper. They're just pieces of paper. They didn't do anything to earn these pieces of paper. They just own the pieces of paper, and they issue them to a person, typically, when they come in for a home loan. The bank's not loaning anybody anything. They're just issuing you some paper, and then they make their money by charging usury. That's how the bank makes its money. The mob. They're a big mob. The small banks get a little cut, and then the guys at the top get a big cut. And they're all part of it. Yeah, anybody that argues that a credit union is any better than any other bank or something like that is just does not understand what is going on, does not want to admit it.
Well, are local alternative currencies legal?
Yes, as long as you don't denominate them in dollars and just make them look like Federal Reserve notes in any way. You can't put like U.S. note or anything on there that can possibly mislead people into believing that it's a
FRN, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, here's the other thing was, can gold and silver be used in conjunction with local alternative currencies, such as serving it as backing?
Well, you could, but there's no reason to. Whose gold and silver is going to back the currency? And who, if somebody comes to that person to redeem their gold or silver, what are they going to do? Say, how do the gold-backed dollars, just for simplicity's sake, we'll call them dollars, how do they get into circulation? Does the guy with the gold, does he buy stuff with the dollars, the gold-backed dollars, or does he loan out those gold-backed dollars and charge usury just because he's got a vault full of gold sitting there doing nothing? You know, how do these gold-backed dollars get into circulation? And if somebody comes to this guy to redeem their gold after earning a gold-backed dollar, is he going to say, yes, here's your gold?
So you think it's ridiculous for the most part?
It's people grasping onto some kind of solution that they really haven't thought it through much, you know?
Okay. Do you think that strands of precious metals placed inside of cards such as Shire silver can function as a de facto local alternative currency, or is it more accurate to think of that more as a form of barter?
They're actually, it's not just some gold leaf pasted onto the piece of paper that's or silver leaf. It's actually a weighty amount of
well,
metal.
Yeah, like again, Shire Silver is really the only example I know of, but they'll sell cards like a half gram or 1 gram or 5 grams of silver, also for gold, 1/20 of a gram, 1/10, 5/10. And I think what they do is that they take strands of the metals and they wrap it around basically into a card so that it, well, theoretically at least, would fit inside like a wallet.
Yeah, that's a legitimate commodity. You're trading a commodity for another commodity.
So that's more like barter then.
Yeah. It's when we get into debt-based currencies. You and I owe you. And I would argue that that was actually what got Adam and Eve kicked out of the Garden of Eden. you got this story of a serpent that beguiles Eve into eating from the tree with a evil fruit with that has the knowledge of good and evil. Two controlled opposition factors there. It's all evil, but it's the knowledge of good and evil. This serpent, which is, you notice the dollar sign, it's a squiggly line with a line through it. It kind of says to me that she said, "You owe me." And Adam said, "Yes, I owe you." And that's when everything fell apart.
That's a funny way of putting it.
Yeah, it's as soon as we get into this, instead of direct trade, we start making IOUs to people. Now you've opened the door,
right?
For the banker to start loaning the IOUs. Say you owe me an IOU.
Yeah, and then they play games with the money supply and everything else, right? Now, speaking of history, why is the Gilded Age imperative to understanding our current problems?
Well, it's just a good example of how a fiat currency could be used to create a massive industrial boom, you know? When there's just massive natural resources to be exploited by whoever can organize the labor to extract them out of the ground and shape them into useful implements and whatever. People believe that they're getting paid to do this because they get to keep a portion of what they're extracting out of the ground and turning into products because this currency is flowing, creating the ability to pool resources and coordinate operations, businesses, whatever. I think that's they were gilding metal base metal coins with gold and silver. Gold leaf basically. I don't know if they had electroplating, but so that people thought, there was that the coin itself had inherent value. It was a commodity in itself when it wasn't. It was just a symbol of debt. Massive technology got developed, but, it's all leading, unfortunately, to our destruction through poisoning ourselves, ultimately, and constant war. So it's like, what's better, just this society that we have now, or would we just be better off if we had never developed all this technology, you know. Just, we're
right.
trapped.
Right, understandable. Well, let's take the next several minutes and let's take a look at some examples of local alternative currencies. So what do you think of the following local alternative currencies, Philo? Let's start with Berkshares.
Not real familiar with them, but you know, they denominate them in shares. That's kind of an interesting way of denominating them. I know that there are like banks in that region that are utilizing that currency. So basically, in an attempt to destroy the bank, they just basically supplement the banking industry.
What they say on their about page is, you know, what are Berkshares? And I posted this in the chat room, but guys can just simply go to berkshares.org. That is berkshares.org. So what are Berkshares? Berkshares are a local currency for the Berkshire region of Massachusetts. Dubbed a great economic experiment by the New York Times, Berkshares are a tool for community empowerment, enabling merchants and consumers to plant the seeds for an alternative economic future for their communities. Launched in the fall of 2006, Berkshares had a robust initiation, with over 1 million Berkshares having been circulated in the first 9 months and over 2.7 million to date. Currently, more than 400 businesses have signed up to accept the currency. 5 different banks have partnered with Berkshares, with a total of 13 branch offices now serving as exchange stations. For Berkshares, this is only the beginning. Future plans could involve Berkshares checking accounts, ETFs, ATMs, and even loans.
Yeah, I don't... it's just... I mean, maybe it's... there are people probably employed that wouldn't be had they... if there was no Berkshires in that region, but there's still chemtrails being dumped over these people, you know?
Oh, come on. The geoengineering aerosol spraying we have to save for another broadcast, man. That's not fair. You're bringing in a tangent.
I know. And if people are still consuming the pharmaceuticals that the TV is pumping them to consume, you know, it's just like people just, we're dreamers, you know, we have to hold on to the dream.
All right, well, let's take a look at another one, and this one is called The Plenty. At their website, theplenty.org, that is theplenty.org, The Plenty Currency Cooperative, or PCC, promotes local commerce, environmental responsibility, self-reliance, and neighborliness, the implementation and support of a local currency, which is the Plenty, the Piedmont Local Economy Tender. Here's how it works. People have been using Plenties to buy goods and services in our neck of the woods since 2002. It's completely legal. It's taxed the same as dollars. It's secure, and it's good for our local economy. So... it's interesting. It's this Piedmont region. So, Philo, what are your thoughts about the Plenty?
Ah, God, I was just distracted by my neighbor there for a second. Could you reiterate the?
Yeah, sure. It's a completely legal and it's taxed the same as dollars. But here's the thing. I mean, even on their about page, they're still pretty vague about it. They say it's backed by trust. Keeping the local economy strong by spending it, but they don't really get too much into what it is, at least on their about page. And then they show some nice, you know, pictures of some of their...
Yeah. You know, one thing we've got to understand is that what the dollar, what the Federal Reserve note is backed by is the person that borrowed it into existence. Is that what you are going to be able to purchase with that dollar if you earn it is something that whoever borrowed it to like buy a house initially does at their job. For instance, if they're a theater usher, when you go to that theater to watch a movie, you buy a ticket. That's what that dollar was backed by, is all these debt dollars are created when a debt is established, and then the usher takes that dollar that he borrowed for the house back to the bank. The debt is extinguished. You did something to earn the dollar, and then you watched a movie to extinguish the debt. There was a debt created, the debt was extinguished. Any community currency is the same thing. Is whoever was issued the currency initially, they purchased something, that's when a debt was established, and then when they produce something to earn that currency back, the debt is extinguished, and the currency is sitting in their pocket. It provides liquidity. There is liquidity. That's another. That's what currency does. That's how we develop the technology, the ability to pool resources, is we create liquidity.
Right. There's also another one called the Ithaca hours. And this is based on the time dollars type system. For guys listening later on the podcast version, go over to IthacaHours.info. That is Ithaca, I-T-H-A-C-A, IthacaHours.info. What they say on their about page is Ithaca Hours is a local currency system that promotes local economic strength and community self-reliance in ways that will support economic and social justice, ecology, community participation, and human aspirations in and around Ithaca, New York. They have over 900 participants that publicly accept Ithaca Hours for goods and services. Additionally, some local employers and employees have agreed to pay or receive partial wages in Ithaca Hours with the goal of keeping money local. They then, if you kind of scroll a little bit down, they also apparently offer business loans at no interest, which I find interesting. They mention the main concern a business often has when considering accepting the hours is, what will I do with the hours I get from customers or clients? The first thing to note is that you decide what rate of hours you will accept for purchases or services. Some member businesses accept 100% hours, but many limit the hours they will accept. So you should calculate the rate of hours that is proportional to your ability to put them back into the local economy. In thinking about this, you may be surprised to learn that, in fact, there are many outlets for the use of hours, and they apparently have a directory. So, again, it's the notion of the time dollar system.
Yeah, which makes sense if, like I say, if a false flag currency collapse happened here in the United States, which is always possible. If for some reason there was a major power outage, you know, and the banks shut down, or, you know, something got wiped out, there could be boxcars full of $100 bills, or even $1,000 or $10,000 or $100,000 Federal Reserve notes, for all we know, sitting somewhere. There could be boxcars all over the country waiting to be unleashed, you know, in a Zimbabwe type currency collapse. False flag type of thing, and it would be good to have a community currency denominated in ours to, you know, kind of help people, you know, keep trucking along, unfortunately, because we just can't fathom bartering, you know. We have no concept of how that would work.
You know? Yeah, exactly. I mean, technically, I mean, the argument has always been made that the invention of money was supposed to overcome the limitations of barter, or at least that's what we were told.
Yeah, it was to overcome the limitations of the bankers not controlling the planet is ultimately what it actually boils down to.
All right. Well, there's also something called the North Fork Shares. Again, guys, that's located at nfshares.com. That is N, like a Nancy, nfshares.com. And, you know, they don't really have an about. They more have an FAQ page. Probably one of the more relevant stuff is, you know, are North Fork Shares real money? Yes, at present, no monetary systems are backed by an actual commodity such as gold, but instead notes are simply declared to be money by an authority, which is fiat money. In the case of U.S. currency, that authority is the national government. Well, it's actually the Federal Reserve, but anyway. In the case of NF shares, that authority are its members. North Fork shares are taxable, and it's illegal to counterfeit them. Well, I find that interesting. And what's interesting is, what is a share worth? You know, one share is worth $12 or 1 hour of labor, which I find interesting. So they're still pricing it. They're still pricing it in terms of, you know, current FRNs, but
It's just
well, here is interesting. You mentioned before about, like, when we looked over Berkshires, you mentioned the fact it's called a share. Well, with North Fork Shares, they actually have a questionnaire about why is it called a share. The name share is meant to remind you that in addition to being a medium of exchange for commodities, currency represents someone's labor, the time taken to provide a skill or perform a service. Your time is worth something to someone else. When you give someone a share, you are telling them, I did this much somewhere else. Please give me the equivalent here.
Yeah, and I can understand why, you know, I used to think that's kind of communistic, you know, until I really realized what was going on in reality. And the reality is that in an actual free market, totally free market, no private bank controlling any cash supply, people would be pretty much evened out real fast, you know?
Yeah.
You just wouldn't have, it wouldn't be possible for people to acquire portfolios, you know?
Or at least not very easily, yeah.
Even if a guy managed to acquire massive amounts of implements, shovels and pickaxes or whatever, you know, was being able to be produced in a primitive economy, nobody would want to use them unless the guy was, like, really nice, you know? It'd be like, if we're not keeping what we produce with your tools, we're not going to use your tools, you know? That's a free market, you know? It's when you're forced to use other people's tools because there's absolutely no way in this slave market that you are going to ever be able to acquire the major implements yourself. We're forced to use other people's factories to produce stuff, you know?
Well, what I found interesting was the last question on there on North Fork Shares FAQ was, who controls the supply of the shares? And I'm like, that's kind of a big deal, right? Money supply, basically. Well, it's the members of the people who decide to participate in the shares. Okay, that's fine. But there's also a board. Ah, crap.
Yeah, I attended a board of a local currency in my region a few weeks ago, and one of the things they pointed out is, oh, yeah, did you know that this one business over here has acquired like $7,000 worth of us currency, the local currency. They don't know what to do with it because they were, you know, were accepting just nothing but the currency, the local currency for their, is a spa or something. And so basically they were trying to dump the currency for, federal, you know, pennies on the dollar, basically, you know, and that's probably a typical thing that happens in any of these community currencies is that you don't hear about is, you know, a business sells a bunch of their product for a ton of the local currency and then ends up just dumping it for, you know, 50 cents on a dollar or something.
Yeah. Another one, too, is something called Detroit Cheers, which is obviously in Detroit, Michigan. The more formal term is the Detroit Community Script, and there's a Wikipedia page on that. They don't seem to have a website from what I can tell. So, guys, just go over to Wikipedia, type in Detroit Cheers or Detroit Community Script. You know, and it says on there, it's modeled upon the local script that was used during the Great Depression, since it was being used to restore local economic confidence. Here's the funny part. The Cheers are backed by U.S. currency and are fully exchangeable for an equal amount of U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
What the hell? Why? I mean, why have it at that point? If you're tying your local alternative currency to the government money, what the fuck are you doing? I thought the whole point was to try and get around inflation and all of that stuff so that it wasn't equal. So when the dollar, you know, collapses or it's a slow death or whatever version it takes or combination of versions, you know, the idea being was that theoretically your local alternative currency was supposed to pull you through or at least be part of a comprehensive strategy that altogether would pull you through.
Yeah, I mean, the best an alternative currency is ever going to do is just educate people as to what is going on with money in the first place. And unfortunately, these people that are starting these community currencies don't even understand it themselves. They just...
Well, yeah.
They're trying to come up with a solution, but they're not even educating people. I mean, if anything, people should understand that when you borrow money from a bank, you're just borrowing paper. They didn't do anything to earn the paper. They cut down a tree and made a whole bunch of $100 bills, and they're loaning that out at usury. And what these community currencies are doing is the exact same thing, except they're not loaning it at usury. But they're insisting that they're not even loaning it in the first place. It's like, talk about shoot yourself in the foot, you know?
I mean, well, yeah. And here's the funny thing is that the Detroit Cheers are a type of scrip. And scrip is basically a currency substitute that's not legal tender and often a form of credit. So, frankly, when we start talking about scrip, we also have to look at the Revolutionary era, you know, because there were some pretty disastrous stuff that happened with colonial scrip. For example, the Continental Congress issued paper money during the war, known as Continental Currency, to fund it. But unfortunately, they depreciated so rapidly that they were worthless by the time the war concluded.
Yeah, that was because of counterfeiting by the offshore bankers.
Hmm.
But it just goes to show, the bankers will always win. either there's just no way to have a debt-based currency that the bankers won't win.
Yeah, I mean, right, and the script was depreciated so badly during the war that there's that for that infamous phrase about, you know, something being, quote, not worth a continental. So, I mean, that is has kind of lived in infamy just, you know, vernacularly, just because it was so bad.
The best you can do is basically try to usurp the national bankers like Muammar Gaddafi did. But look what happened to him, you know? There's just no way you're going to beat these guys by playing their own game, is what I'm saying. And ultimately, the only way you're going to beat them is if, like I say, some kind of supernatural force takes over and starts directing people what to do every day and assures them that they will be compensated for their, you know, what they're doing, you know, without using any dollar bills.
Right. You know, another local alternative currency, too, is something called the Brooklyn Torch. And, you know, looking over their website, it's interesting. They say that, and for you guys listening later on the podcast version, they're located over at brooklyntorch.org. That is Brooklyn, B-R-O-O-K-L-Y-N, Torch, brooklyntorch.org. But they say right here on their main index or homepage that we are a local currency project aimed at providing a paper means of exchange in North Brooklyn that will circulate and support the resident community in North Brooklyn. The Brooklyn Torch will bring together communities living in our neighborhoods to improve social and economic integration. You know, it's something interesting I'm noticing, Philo, by attempting to try to get definitions and as well as more specific details, even just in a very general sense, on how each of these different currencies work, but only very few, like maybe one or two or whatever, gave any sort of even introductory or basic detail into how they work. Otherwise, it's more or less these general platitudes about, you know, improving the economy or whatever. But I find interesting there's nothing ever anything relatively specific most of the time.
Right.
I mean, it almost sounds like it's like propaganda in the negative sense.
Well, it's people being in denial. Because if you sit there and think about it for too long, you're just going to realize that you're wasting your time. You know, that's the problem. They don't want to sit there and think about it. They'll insist there's no debt involved. I mean, if you just think it through long enough, you're going to realize that you're just putting a Band-Aid on the situation. And the only way to deal with reality is to accept it, you know, as it is, and proceed from there, as dismal as it can seem to be. But, you know, Karl Marx basically went crazy. Going with his approach, which was to serve the banking industry. and died young, you know, relatively young. But he knew there was no way to get rid of it without going to just a primitive culture. Hopefully I'm not going to go crazy fighting this.
I think that would be kind of a concern with anyone who's trying to resist tyranny. Okay, now obviously we've kind of looked at a sampling of local alternative currency, so we can notice some similarities and probably only a minor amount of differences with each one. Now, taking a look at something else, you know, obviously it bears us out to learn from history lest we be doomed to repeat it. So why was Bernard von Nuthaus, who's the inventor of the Liberty Dollar, convicted of counterfeiting?
Well, he was, because somebody thought that it was a federally issued currency and claimed they got duped, and then the jury determined that, yeah, this looks a little too much like a federal currency, and so ultimately, yeah, he got convicted. That was, you know, his approach was he should have just spent his resources trying to educate people as to how the monetary system actually works. But see, he didn't even really understand, you know. That's the problem. People don't understand what they're getting into, and then they jump the gun with some, you know, hopefully some kind of solution. And
interesting how that theme keeps popping up now and again. For you guys listening later on the podcast version, do an internet search for Bernard von Nuthaus. And von Nuthaus, obviously V-O-N. Nuthaus is spelled N-O-T-H-A-U-S. Again, Nuthaus is spelled N-O-T-H-A-U-S. A-U-S, Bernard von Nuthaus. Interesting case study, at the very least, just so that we don't have any more of our people getting railroaded by the government whenever they try to do something constructive. Now, what do you think of Paul Grignon's digital coin concept?
Pretty much the same as any other community currency, except strictly on a digital platform. The Bitcoin is already being established.
Do you think Bitcoin has any real viability? Since it is a purely digital currency, and as such, you never physically touch it at any point. I mean, do you think it can really work?
Well, it's work for what? You know, what are you trying to achieve? It's not going to collapse the banking industry. You know, it at best it can be used as an education tool, but it's not. People are approaching it like it's some kind of actual solution. You know, and analyzing Paul Grignon's videos, there's, you know, he does have a pretty good understanding about a lot of things that a lot of other monetary policy reformers don't understand. But there's a lot of things in his videos I'm just like watching, I cringe. You know, it's like, that doesn't make sense. You know, type of stuff. You know, I'd have to take it line by line analysis to really point out what I'm talking about, but
Well, it says on this one Bitcoin website that it was one of the first implementations of a concept called cryptocurrency, which was first described in 1998 by Y Dai on the Cypherpunk's mailing list, building upon the notion that money is any object or any sort of record accepted as payment for goods and services and repayment of debts in a given country or socioeconomic context. Bitcoin is designed around the idea of using cryptography to control the creation and transfer of money rather than relying on central authorities. So basically, it's a P2P digital currency of sorts. And for guys listening later, one of the several Bitcoin sites that I'm referring to tonight is bitcoin.org. So basically, it's a decentralized currency.
Yeah. You know, interesting thing, I'm not sure I haven't looked at in the stores at the Monopoly games, but I read an article where Monopoly is going to be selling games with a electronic accounting computer.
They already do. It's called the I know what you're talking about. It's called the I think it's like the electronic cash version or whatever. But yeah, they actually jacked the price on it by like $10 or $15 or $20 or whatever it is. It actually is a more expensive version because you have to have a little device thingy that reads the cards. But they have that, and you actually have the credit card type thing or debit card, if you will. And you swipe, 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 and that's how it's all done. Oh, I think it's called like the electronic banking version, I think is what it is. But yeah, instead of having the paper Monopoly money, you swipe, swipe, swipe with the card, and that's how everything is tallied, or at least supposedly that's how it works.
Yeah, you potentially, I don't know how many, I'm sure there's a limit to how many players that will handle, but if you had one of those little computers with, a thousand players, or a bunch of them interconnected throughout the community, you could just use those and debit cards, which are more aptly referred to as debt cards. Why they got us calling debit or credit cards, when they're just their debt card. You're transferring debt, establishing debt, extinguishing debt, transferring debt card. But you could have a paperless currency going with that, all these people that are afraid of the cashless society, it's like cash, the electronic cash is cash, okay? It doesn't matter if it's like 5% of our cash supply is represented by paper bills and coins already, only 5%. And if that was gotten rid of it, there's still cash. It's just electronically transferred cash. It's not cashless, But I mean, I'm all for anonymity. I even developed a way of turning any piece of paper into an anonymous bill of cash. With modern technology, you can just tear the corner off of a piece of paper that's about the size of a bill, scan it, and now you can't counterfeit that because that you gave it a fingerprint, and anybody with a scanner could scan it and tell that represented, actual debt that somebody established at a bank, and they were they could have it credited to their checking account. But anyway, that's a whole other.
Right. And the concept of the cashless society actually should be saved for a different broadcast, because there's a certain privacy and Big Brother, surveillance police state apparatus aspect to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did. But yeah, I mean, like, for example, if you guys go to Amazon.com and look for the Monopoly Electronic Banking Edition by Hasbro, even some of the product description mentions about that, the rules are still the same, but now you're just swiping cards for pretty much. Interestingly enough, each player starts with $15 million in their bank card account, and the banker adds amounts, such as when the player passes go, or subtracts, such as when the player pays to get out of jail, by inserting the player's card in the plus or minus slot of the banker unit. That's the computer device thing, which is why they jack up the price. When one player has to pay another player, the banker debits or credits each account as appropriate. So the electronic banking is neat and easy to handle, and as an additional added educational bonus, the player will take who takes on the banker role will quickly become familiar with basic bookkeeping concepts. The bank cards operate more like debit than credit, so players will learn responsible money management, i.e. not how to run up credit card debt.
Yeah, what a joke. Well, as if the bank doesn't know everything about you already. That's what I got to say about what we were touching on before. But, Monopoly. It's funny because what they don't tell you in, when you start to play that game is the bank already won. You know? And if there was no money, there would be no game.
Exactly.
I've often thought of actually creating a realistic Monopoly game. I'm thinking about calling it Comopoly.
What?
But just really illustrate how the bank just takes these pieces of paper, loans them out, charges usury, and just ultimately ends up owning everything in the game. It's the game that the bank already won. It's not real fun,
Well, I mean, there was also that other game, I think it was called, like, Anti-Monopoly or something like that. But, yeah, I think you should definitely design Comopoly. That definitely sounds good, since it really is has very communistic characteristics at the very least. Moving on, in terms of other monetary reform proposals, what are your thoughts on G. Edward Griffin's A Plan for Eliminating the Fed monetary reform proposal?
That's a total joke. The guy just, I don't know, he's either got no concept of how money is created in the first place. He can read what the Fed says it's created, which is a bunch of BS. But I mean, obviously they're not going to tell you the truth about the fact that they're just loaning out pieces of paper and charging usury. In its simplest, most simple explanation. So. No.
All right. Now, what are your thoughts on Gary Hunt's an economic solution monetary reform proposal that was featured on episode 48?
Just same thing. You know, I hate to. I know Gary's like. He's got a lot of good things to say on everything, pretty much, but monetary policy. Well read on the propaganda that has been pumped out there. If you got to identify it as propaganda. It's just, the greenbacker movement, that's not going to work. And then anything having to do with incorporating a commodity like gold, that's, just a way of keeping the current guys in control of the monetary system already, keeping them in charge,
Now, have you changed your mind concerning your own monetary reform proposal, which is known currently as public issued currency and brokerages, not banks, which was mentioned when I had you on last time on episode 40, monetary reform?
Yeah. That approach, which is basically doing what community currencies are doing, but on a national scale and formalizing it,
if anything, is the most logical approach to monetary policy. But I've gone through it in my mind numerous times, and it's painful to think about because I was really pushing this for, you know, a good 2 years after a year of developing it, you know, as a solution. But when I started getting into the minds of your typical investor, that, you know, low-level rich guy, it just became apparent to me that that the system, that the only reason a book entry accounting tool, debt-based accounting tool, would be created in the first place is so that somebody can extract the labor or, you know, or intellectual property, whatever, of somebody else in order to profit. And once you cross that line in any way, you're gonna end up with a pyramid with the bankers on top every time. There's there's no way my system's gonna work. But, you know, if anybody really concerned about monetary policy wants to delve into it as much as I have, you know, I'll be glad to explain everything I understand about money and the physics of it. And if they can, like, convince me that, no, it will work, or I got a way to improve it, you know, I'm all ears, you know. But like I say, it's just, there is no reason for creating an accounting tool unless you're trying to organize a system to where you can sit on your butt doing nothing and watch other people work while you are living in a way better house, you know, and that's where it all falls apart. So,
right now, something I've noticed on your videos is you like to really use a whiteboard. So, Philo, why do you prefer drawing pictures over writing words?
Because we do not have the vocabulary to really communicate, especially on monetary policy, economics in general. If you analyze what people are saying, if you really, you know, take any economist talking about anything, money, Mises Institute, whoever, you know, on the radio, whatever, and you just really break down every sentence they say, every word, it's really a bunch of gibberish. And you have to draw a picture. That's why the Native Americans would not conform, because they always had the ground and a stick to grab to draw a picture to communicate with each other. They're communicating with imagery, or I refer to it as eidetic thinking is in imagery and not in words. And so when you think that way, you're just not going to fall for
somebody trying to get you to borrow a gold coin or a piece of paper and pay them usury for borrowing that. You know, it makes sense to, like, if you borrow a tool, if you borrow a shovel from somebody, you know, to, like, hoe a little bit of ground for them, you know, if you're, you know, hoeing your garden, you know, and it's that guy's shovel, you know, maybe you go hoe a couple rows for him, you know. But to borrow a gold coin or a piece of paper and pay somebody usury, that, you know, to a rational mind, that does not make sense. But in our culture, where we're not taught to think eidetically, we're just taught to memorize long strands of words that don't even make sense. You know, like the word debt. And we always say that, you know, that guy's in debt to that guy, or I'm in debt to somebody. We are in debt with other people. Nobody's in debt to anybody. People are in debt with each other. You might be thinking, why does that make sense? What's the significance of that? But it is so significant. You know, when we use terms like buy and sell, we're not saying we traded. We're saying we bought or we sold. There's a trade and a buy and sell are two different things. A trade, there's no debt established. When you buy something, it's because you're using money and you're either establishing a debt or you're transferring a debt. When you sell something, you're using money and you're either establishing a debt or extinguishing a debt. I even have to think that through. I'd have to get the whiteboard out and draw myself some pictures to.
Right. Well, something also that I wanted to ask you about was, you know, can the commodity that's known as hemp be used to repair the economy, at least in part?
Well, it's like the whole issue over electricity. I mean, it's such a productive plant that it can't really be unleashed upon society without seriously disrupting the program. You know, they can't unleash free electricity if, in fact, it's true. You know, that a lot of people say that it would be really easy to extract electricity with right out of the atmosphere with you still need the technology, the components to construct one of these things, that like a probe that goes down in the ground so far and then an antenna that goes up so far and then the whatever capacitors and transformers, you know, hidden technology that would totally, you know, if unleashed on the general public, would just totally disrupt the balance that the bankers are keeping on our lives, you know. But, I mean, if we were a totally simplistic agrarian culture, there's no doubt we'd be growing massive amounts of hemp and constructing homes out of it, you know?
Well, if that is the case, Philo, then what is the current legality of it?
Well, it's illegal in the United States. I'm not sure why they're not growing huge fields of it in Canada. Because I know that at least they're pretty liberal as far as medical marijuana, but
Well, all right. And as we begin to wind down for tonight, do you think that the method of counter-economics, and counter-economics being defined as that method or methodology that says if you participate in black and gray markets, then that is somehow effective for circumventing the state?
Yeah, I'm all for, I'm not, you know, telling anybody to follow the rules by any means. But I would suggest that anybody remotely interested in counter economics, learn everything I have to teach them about money so they have a tool to, use in their arsenal against, basically beating back the New World Order with a stick. I mean, that's about all we can do, because, you know, unless we just totally get rid of money completely, would, you know, and I'm not saying that's going to ever happen. I'm not a zeitgeister, you know,
right. Well, Philo, I would like to thank you so much for coming back on. I really do appreciate it. Since last time I had you on, we kind of ran out of time since we were using the Blog Talk Radio interface. And so I'm just glad that we could actually kind of flesh out a lot of the other stuff that we didn't get a chance to go through. So thank you very much for coming back on.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. That was Philo. And if you want to learn more about him, you can visit his YouTube channel over at youtube.com/philoplatt, PhiloPlatt, Philoplatt over on YouTube. If you have found this particular episode of the Last Bastille podcast or any of YHTOM's other broadcasts insightful or otherwise useful to you, please consider financially supporting us. You can do that by buying Colonel Joseph P. Martino's book, Resistance to Tyranny, from us by visiting youhavetreadonme.com/resistance_to_tyranny.html. Dr. Martino is a retired Air Force colonel. He served in Thailand, where he conducted research on counterinsurgency. He was later chairman of the Counterinsurgency Working Group of the Military Operations Research Society. He teaches a course in just war doctrine at Yorktown University. He also holds degrees in physics, electrical engineering, and mathematics. So this man is absurdly competent and not just about this book's subject matter. Please keep in mind that we are independent media, as we are not funded by either the government or despotic corporate special interests. So, if you wish for us to keep the archives up online, as well as continuing to make more broadcasts, we do need to meet our monetary expenses. So please support us by buying a copy of Dr. Martino's book for approximately $18. This is a must-read for every militia unit, committee of safety, and frankly, every other political dissident who wishes to, what else, resist tyranny. For next week's episode on Saturday, May 12th, we will be taking a very special look at privacy. I'm Sleepy Salsa, and thanks for listening.